special edition part two this week with our great friend Zach Osterman from the Indianapolis Star, the beat writer for Indiana basketball and football and soccer and baseball and all the wonderful things that are going on. Heck, spring football starts tomorrow. Well, that's interesting. Kurt Cignetti's first go-around with Indiana University football. We don't mean to put that on the back burner, but we will get to that before the spring game on April 18th, Thursday night. But it is NCAA tournament time, and if it's NCAA tournament time, that means the regular season is over. And as we discussed on Monday, the transfer portal is open for business. And yesterday, my great friend, we followed your reporting and saw that at least two official Indiana Hoosiers are in the portal. Other reports suggest it's three. Where are we here on well, this is Wednesday, so this is day three of the transfer portal. Well, we're just getting started, aren't we? Good afternoon, buddy. How are you?
Yeah, we are, I guess, as things stand right now, so far as I know, three Indiana players, CJ Gunn, Caleb Banks, Peyton Sparks, are all in the portal. I don't think any of those is a huge surprise. I think, you know, when you look at Gunn and Banks, you could kind of see the writing on the wall in terms of the way their, you know, their playing time had changed. You know, Gunn got some run toward the end of the season, but, you know, there's I'm just looking at the numbers here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 games from January 19th onward in which he plays 7 or fewer minutes. There are only 6 games in that stretch in which he plays at least 10. Banks obviously, you know, fell even further out of the rotation. He only appeared in 2 games across the last basically month and a half of the season. And Sparks is maybe a little bit of a different case. Wouldn't necessarily be a transfer candidate except for the temporary injunction that is basically barring the NCAA from enforcing a lot of its transfer rules. So he can go back in the portal having just transferred in from Ball State. I guess he could also be a grad transfer as well. But even if he's not, he would still be eligible going somewhere else. You know, again, a player who, you know, only appeared in double-digit minutes once, beginning with the January 27th loss at Illinois on through the end of the season. So, you know, three players that ultimately I think it probably shouldn't be surprising to see them looking for something else, some other options, and Indiana obviously heading in that direction as well.
Now, the numbers game is the numbers game, and that won't change, but it will change because it can change. We learned last year you don't have to have 13 scholarships filled. Indiana did not. I don't think that helped any of their cause last season. But if we start getting out our abacus and adding up who is not here, that would be Xavier Johnson, Anthony Walker, the three you just mentioned in the portal, and a scholarship that wasn't used last year. So half this roster almost is going to turn over. Is this a blank canvas where fans should be excited, where you should be able to fix this quickly? Didn't Nebraska have 4 of their 5 starters transfer people and they finished 3rd in the league this year? What is the mindset going forward in the rebuild? Is this good, bad? What should we think? Or do we just have to be the word everybody hates, patient, and figure out where this is going to go? What do you see here in the early hours before May 1st hits?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, you know, there's a few things I would say. Number one, we don't have a huge sample size. The the historical numbers we do have on teams that tend to be fairly transfer reliant, you know, let's say half or more of your roster being newly arrived transfers, don't tend to do terribly well, to be completely honest with you. You know, I think somebody put out a stat this year pointing out, you know, like St. John's was a team, I'm struggling to remember them all, but that basically there weren't really many, if any, teams that were going to be heavily reliant on transfers that were going to, you know, that this was a few weeks ago, looked likely to make the NCAA tournament. So it's one of those things where basically, I think it's, I don't want to sit here and say it is absolutely, you know, terrible or whatever. It is something that I think it's probably fair to say is difficult to navigate. I don't think that's unfair. On the other hand, Indiana was ready for this. I mean, Indiana had to be ready for this, you know, just in terms of recognizing, as you said, the players that were graduating, the players that were likely to were likely to want to move on because of playing time. Then you always factor in, you know, a Khalil Ware potentially going to the NBA. You factor in the possibility of somebody you didn't necessarily want to transfer entering the portal. So it's just kind of the point is Indiana should have known, and I suspect will have known, that Indiana was that this was where it was going to wind up. And it's just about basically trying to make the trying to make it work, trying to make it make sense.
And trying to make it make sense is nothing Indiana basketball fans want to do right now. They just want this to be fixed. They want Dalton Connect. They want all the guys that transferred last year that we missed on to figure it out this year. I guess more of a philosophical question to this be, and nobody likes to talk about it, but it's going to be the case. I don't think Mike Woodson will get another chance to have another 6 or 7 transfer portal scholarship availability to rebuild this. Do you believe that to be accurate moving forward? If we're sitting here on March 20th of 2025 and having the same issues, I don't think he'll get another chance to do that.
That's probably fair. I don't think that's a huge leap. I mean, you know, you never want to sort of say, you know, that this is, you know, absolutely the case or absolutely what's going to happen. But I think it, you know, given just the direction of everything kind of that Indiana's the direction of travel Indiana's been on for the last year or so, I don't think it's a huge leap to assume that, you know, the program would be a lot closer to major change if next season doesn't represent a fairly significant turnaround, if that makes sense.
It does. And the other part of this as well is just there seems to be a torn factions that are developing here on, well, if you have that many, you've got to get it right. And my response to that is, no, you don't. You have to get some of it right. There's never been a roster in college basketball where 12 of the 13 players had played 20 minutes a game and scored 10 points. Why are we under that belief that we have to rebuild this as perfect?
Well, I think it's more the idea that, you know, frankly, at the risk of being overly simplistic, I mean, Indiana kind of wound up in a place where it did not particularly work this past offseason, at least not well enough as it needed to. And that's not just maybe, you know, starter level guys we're talking about. You know, you had your Khalil Wares. You know, I could even go as far as an Anthony Walker, you know, turning into a pretty solid bench piece for Indiana. But your bench never really rounded out. You know, you took a guy like Peyton Sparks that ultimately never kind of got to a place where it felt like his role was, you know, contributing. And that's not, listen, that's not, that is not always entirely obviously down to the player, but it's just, it's kind of the idea that basically we saw, we saw Indiana set out to do something not hugely dissimilar to this a year ago. They knew they were losing Trace Jackson Davis and Jalen Hood-Giafino. They had a pretty good idea Xavier Johnson was coming back. They can't have known that for certain. They knew they were losing Race Thompson and Miller Kopp, and then Jordan Geronimo and Tamar Bates graduated. And then Logan Duncan transferred as well, or not graduated, excuse me, all three of those players transferred, sorry. Getting mixed up in my own thoughts here. My point is, Indiana went into last offseason, obviously with more maybe wind in its sails in terms of program momentum, but it still went into last offseason with a lot of the same concerns and a lot of the same, you know, sort of, hey, we need some pieces that will be starters. We need some pieces that will be contributing bench players, essentially. And even though Indiana was able to land a big fish in Khalil Ware, even though Indiana was able to, you know, did kind of get the unexpected opportunity of adding McKenzie Mbako, because he, no one necessarily projected he would be, you know, decommitting from Duke. The point is, the overall process still didn't work. And I think when you talk about basically kind of people saying, well, you know, we need this, we need this, and you're right, not every one of these guys is going to come in and score a lot of points or play a lot of minutes or immediately start. But it's kind of more the idea that, like, we saw Indiana do all this, even looking for reserves, even looking for, you know, key pieces last year, and it still didn't really work. So at least not to the level that Indiana will have expected it to, not to the level that Indiana will have needed it to. So, I mean, I just think it's kind of one of those where you saw Indiana try to do this to a certain extent a year ago. Now Indiana is trying to do it again, and you know, they got to do it better than they did it a year ago.
And that's the next question. You've had one chance to put it together. That perhaps didn't work the way you wanted it to. This brave new world that we're living in, where nobody gets there's not enough time. There's too much time. We're going to miss out on these guys, these players, everything else. College basketball has absolutely lost its mind, unless you're like, I don't know, Garden, Wisconsin. They've been in the tournament 23 out of 25 years, ho-hum. They just kind of go along and do their business. I'm not saying they're the poster child for this, but you've got, you know, Tom Izzo's arguing. He's yelling at clouds today up in the sky about the tournament doing this and that. Where are we headed with all of this? I mean, there's if you don't like it, everybody leaves, and then you have to rebuild it the next year. How do you get over or out of this cycle? And I know if you knew that answer, they'd pay you $6 million a year to coach the team. But at some point, where do we drop our anchor, reset, and try to get this figured out? That's a tough question, I know, and I don't expect you to have a perfect answer, but it just feels it's despair. Every time you don't make the tournament, it's the end of the world.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's the difficult piece of this that is, I mean, it's probably driven a little bit by the transfer portal in the sense that there's a feeling that you can have a slightly more immediate fix now than you used to be able to. It's probably also just driven, you know, more generally by, you know, the way that conversations between small numbers of people on social media can ultimately, for better or worse, you know, kind of leave you, can guide the narrative, I guess, in a way that they couldn't before. But I do think, you know, I think I used this the last time we were on together. My beat companion, if you want to say, Mike Nieselik said during the Big Ten tournament, he sort of noted that we were talking about Juwan Howard, and obviously he got dismissed that weekend. And Mike said that Michigan had the season Indiana fans think Indiana had. And I thought that was a good way of summing up just – you know, what was and frankly, to a certain extent, what wasn't true about Indiana's season and what, you know, what sort of was or wasn't achieved across the course of the last 6 months. Indiana had a disappointing season, no doubt. But it's sort of been, it is a season that, like, you know, probably too many others for this program in recent years, it is a season that has kind of wound up, you know, getting turned into an indictment of the direction of the program when I'm not necessarily sure that's completely fair. I'm not sure it's completely unfair, to be clear, particularly, I think, you know, with regard to the fact that, you know, we have these kinds of conversations and we're talking about, for example, like, what is the what is the sort of future here? What is the direction of travel of, you know, like just everything that's kind of happening? What is the plan? What is the long-term sort of thinking guiding all of these decisions? But in the same breath, it's also not like the house is on fire. But if you, you know, if you will the house to be on fire at some point, it might just catch on fire. And I think that's the difficulty that I think you've got if you are sort of trying to get your arms around just like the current state and direction of all this is. It's not like last season was a good one, but I also don't know that it's like last season was as bad as maybe we sometimes make it out to be, if that makes any sense. And that can absolutely contribute to a measure of, I don't know, for lack of a better term, a measure of sort of hysteria that maybe isn't quite warranted, but that ultimately absolutely does wind up affecting the overall sort of arc and trajectory of the program.
Zach Osterman, Indy Star, checking in with us, a special edition Wednesday before he heads up to Indianapolis to cover the Purdue Boilermakers for IndyStar.com. We'll have NCAA tournament basketball for you tomorrow and Friday and Saturday and Sunday, starting at noon until that final buzzer of the final game goes off. We thank Zach Osterman as always. We'll take a quick timeout and we'll be back glass in the afternoon here on a Thursday. All right, part two is Zach Osterman here in the Crazy Horse Tavern Happy Hour talking the NCAA tournament. He will be covering the Boilermakers for the Indy Star, as we've been telling you all week, starting in Indianapolis, continuing on to Detroit if Purdue advances, and then it's off to Glendale, Arizona for this year's Final Four. The brackets are out. We have had first four coverage for you last night from Dayton. We'll have Pacers for you tonight, but Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, NCAA hoops from noon till the final game has ended. The bracket 64 will be ready to go tomorrow starting at noon. We've got two more first four games tonight. The Big Ten did not cover itself in glory all season long. We do have, what, six teams in the tournament. There's always consternation about who gets in, who doesn't get in, how they get in, why are they in, who's in. Why is Indiana State out? Why is St. John's or Pittsburgh out or whatever? Well, it's a mess, and I think that's part of the charm of it, whether it works or not. What say you, my good friend?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to get too overly wrapped up in a lot of that stuff. Not that I don't get, I mean, you know, I, Lord knows I was sending my share of tweets on Tuesday night. I thought it was hard to argue with the 4-1 seeds. You know, just from, I guess, the personal perspective of trying to figure out how deep I might follow into the tournament, because I have, as I think you said, picked up Purdue here. I think Purdue got a potentially comfortable draw in terms of maybe
easy teams draw,
not necessarily teams that are bad, but you know, teams that would give them trouble. You know, if I was looking at, like, you know, I don't think I am a little bit curious about Utah State. They have a fascinating story. They're the eighth seed, but you know, I wouldn't have, and you couldn't see it because of bracketing principles. But if I was Purdue, I wouldn't have wanted to see some non-Big Ten version of Nebraska as the eight. I wouldn't have wanted maybe to see a Kentucky as my three, as is in the South, or. You know, I mean, it's kind of a weird one because they beat Alabama earlier in the year, but I'm not sure I'd want to see a team like Alabama because, you know, I think athleticism can give Purdue some trouble. I think the other thing we've learned, and we talked about this a lot, is, you know, with the possible exception of that game against Wisconsin, which went into overtime and was really chopped up by foul trouble, weird foul calls both ways. Teams that beat Purdue tended to be teams that could score with Purdue, and teams that gave Purdue trouble tended to be teams that could score with Purdue, or teams that could turn Purdue over, one of those two things. So I like Purdue's draw. You know, about the only – I can understand the Big East's overall point in terms of, you know, I mean, if you look at, like, the KenPom numbers, for example, they were the number three conference – in the country. So basically, why did all of their bubble teams, St. John's, Nova, Seton Hall, Butler, why did Providence, why did not, you know, why did essentially none of them get in? I don't think any of them did. Maybe am I missing somebody? I'm not sure. But, you know, that's kind of an aggregate thing where it's like, yeah, but if you look at every one of those teams in isolation, I mean, I can make an argument, frankly, for St. John's. But the problem is, you know, this comes down a little bit to how the committee sort of talks to itself. And what I mean by that is, you know, St. John's best wins, for example, are its sweep of Villanova. If you're looking like the KenPom profile, for example, its best wins are its sweep of Villanova, another team that didn't make it in the tournament, its win over Creighton at home, and its win on the road against Butler, another team that didn't make the tournament. So kind of what you get is you can disagree. You can disagree with the committee's sort of thought process, but the committee clearly got to a place where, as a piece, I don't think it liked those Big East bubble teams very much. And it just kind of said, we're not ultimately that impressed by how much you beat up on each other, you know. And again, if we break out every single individual, I mean, Seton Hall beat Marquette, it beat UConn, it beat St. John's, you know, in fact, it swept St. John's. Seton Hall's one that I feel like, again, maybe has a little bit more of a case, but the committee didn't put St. John's in either. So if the committee didn't put St. John's in, then the committee clearly isn't going to value Seton Hall's wins over St. John's as highly. The one that I think a lot of people, including me, have sort of caught on to is Indiana State. And, you know, just the feeling, and it's always tough with mid-majors because ultimately, there is this ever competing sort of discussion of, well, they don't play anybody, but that's because nobody wants to play them. They should schedule tougher, but in the same breath, well, you say schedule tougher, but, you know, they're stuck in the conference they're stuck in, but why should you punish teams that are in, you know, essentially better conferences, like, for example, a Seton Hall, you know, just to kind of use one example. My point here is, you know, I understand why the selection committee, why the job is hard. And I understand why, you know, you wind up in particular, I think, really struggling to evaluate mid-majors. But if you want to, you know, kind of have that conversation, Indiana State is, if I'm not mistaken, the highest ranked team
ever
net, which is the NCAA's own creation, to be left out. And then when, you know, frankly, when you see the performances of some of these, and I know Virginia has kind of become the poster child for this. You know, when you see Virginia, which finished, I don't know where they finished in the net, they finished 73rd in KenPom. You know, Virginia's best wins were Clemson away, Florida on a neutral site. That was back in November.
They all count. You
know, no doubt, but they only beat one team ranked better than KenPom 74 after February 3rd. You know, I mean, and then they go do what they do. I mean, that's the other problem with this, you know, is they go kind of turn in the performance that they turn in.
That surprised absolutely no one except the tournament committee.
Right. And it's just sort of like, hey, you know, would this not have been better off with Indiana State as an example?
Let me ask you a question, because you've been around this a long time. I've been doing this a long time. It's the experience is what we know. I could make an argument. It's better for Indiana State not to have gotten into the tournament because of all the media they've received instead of getting in and getting beat in the first round.
Yeah, I don't know that I agree with that, just because ultimately the final currency of,
if they go on to win the NIT and are in the talking point for the next 3 weeks, that is way better than getting in the tournament and getting beat in the first round. Way
possibly
better. Way possibly better. Not even close, because they make the argument after every win they should be in, and if you get beat in the first round of the tournament, nobody cares whether you should have been in or not. That's true.
I'm not sure I quite agree with that for mid-majors, simply because the opportunity for them to get into the tournament is often so rare.
But it makes their case for 3 weeks how wrong they got it, and that takes you further than it would
if
you
got in there. I guess my counter-argument is, what has that changed?
It hasn't, but the more it happens and the more groundswell that gets behind it, it didn't help today that Tom Izzo comes out and says, this is stupid getting all these mid-majors in here. And you got.
I disagree with that, because I think everything about the current climate of this tournament is moving away from mid-majors. And we've done this a lot where we have said, you know, oh, here's another example of mid-majors needing to be moved on, you know, needing to be respected more or whatever. And then the mid-majors, you know, it just happens every year.
I don't care that Seton Hall's crying. I don't care that Rick Pitino's crying. I don't care about these, you know, the guys.
I just haven't seen it change anything, okay. I guess, is my point. I understand the theory of what you're saying. I have not seen that come out in practice. I've seen a committee that ultimately was often too happy to just kind of, you know, wear the anger and frustration, and then once things died down, just sort of let it go.
You put in a team like Michigan State, who we talked about on Monday. Indiana fans were wondering why they weren't included in that conversation after beating Michigan State. But Sparty always finds a way to get in, even though their net's in the 70-somethings or whatever it was in all of that. So it's just rich from Tom Izzo that we need to make this more elite than it already is in the elite world. So it's interesting, that's for sure. So Indiana State doesn't get in. The handful of Big East teams don't get in. But the Mountain West gets six teams in. I guess we could go around in circles for this all day long. But what's the more surprising part to you, Indiana State and their high net, or a league like the Mountain West all of a sudden gets this respect thrown in their direction?
You know, in fairness to the Mountain West, this has kind of been building. You know, if you think about, like, I'm just pulling up their overall KenPom profile. Like, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams in the Mountain West in the top 50 of KenPom. There's a 7th UNLV in the top 75. You know, New Mexico is a program that obviously has a coach with a bit of pedigree, and you know, Richard Pitino's now won 48 games over the last two seasons. Boise State has been a pretty regular NCAA tournament team. This is Steve Alford's second appearance at Nevada, but if you rewind to the guy he took over for, Eric Musselman, this makes it 5 tournament appearances if we're including the first 4, which I do. I don't agree with people who say that's not the tournament. You're in, it's the tournament. This is 5 appearances in 8 years for Nevada. Obviously, San Diego State, you know, it kind of speaks for itself. Utah State is a little bit, you know, kind of a, has bounced around a little bit more, but, like, you know, Craig Smith took them to 2 tournaments in 3 years. And I think the argument was they would have made it in a 3rd year if COVID hadn't canceled that. Ryan Odom took them to 1 tournament in 2 years. Danny Sprinkle, actually one of the more unheralded stories in the country. I think he returned 0 points from last season and still won 27 games. My point is, there are more of these programs out in the Mountain West that have been winning at a certain level. This is Nico Medved's 2nd tournament in 3 years with Colorado State. There are more of these programs that have been winning at a certain level, quite frankly. And actually, you know, the Mountain West was the top ranked non, if you kind of think of the, you know, I guess we call it a Big Six in college basketball. The Mountain West was 7th behind the, you know, the Big Ten, Big 12, Big East, SEC, ACC, Pac-12. This year, this is KenPom's adjusted conference rankings. They were actually ahead of the ACC last season. They were the best of the rest 2 seasons ago. You have to go back to 2021 for a year where they didn't finish either ahead of at least one of the Big Six or basically the first conference behind the rest of the Big Six. So my point here is, like, they are it is quietly a conference that has managed to really kind of, you know, raise all boats, so to speak. And there's been you know, you've even had a little bit of that consistency too that you don't always get in conferences like that. You know, obviously some jobs have turned over, like UNLV, TJ Otzelberger took Iowa State a couple years ago. But I mean, Leon Rice has been at Boise State forever. You know, San Diego State was obviously Steve Fisher, and then it's been with Brian Dutcher for the last seven seasons. Nico Medved has been at Colorado State for at least a handful of years now. Yeah, this is his sixth season. So you have these programs that have had some success and have invested in keeping coaches around in some cases. It's not a terrible conference. It's not necessarily a conference that you look at and say, you know, oh my gosh, you know, there's a national title contender in there, although obviously San Diego State did play for a national championship last year. But it is a conference that, you know, genuinely has been in and around, you know, if not definitely the best of the rest, one of the best of the rest for a while now.
Zach Osterman, Indy Star, heading to Indianapolis for Purdue. The coverage for the Indianapolis paper will continue as far as the Boilermakers go. All right, wrapping things up before you get on the road and get up to Indianapolis for the busy weekend. When we reconvene next week before you head to Detroit, how many number ones do you believe will still be alive? Houston, Purdue, UConn, and North Carolina, will all four see the second weekend this year?
Let me look at these. Let me take a quick gander back at these brackets. It's certainly hard for me to see UConn having any trouble. I mean, that, you know, if you made me, I haven't done a bracket yet, and I don't know if I will or
they
not.
They will get the winner of Dusty May and Chris Collins in round two.
That for me, I mean, UConn's probably my favorite right now. I do like Purdue's path out of the first round, although I do think Utah State could give them some trouble.
But getting Kansas or Gonzaga, Kansas announced yesterday that Kevin McCullough is done. He is not going to play.
Yeah, and I, you know, even in Tennessee, I think Dalton Connect could give them some trouble. But I've also seen, you know, Tennessee just kind of
Rick Barnes
enough. And I also, you know, I mean, I look at it, and I guess my counterpoint is, what does Tennessee throw at Zach Edey now? You know, Tennessee's eighth in the country in opponent 2-point field goal percentage, but, you know, most that's everybody else. That's not Zach. Excuse me. That's not Zach Edey. The one that I would be a little bit curious about more than anybody else is Houston. And the only reason I would is because, you know, Texas A&M has found a little bit of something here. They won five in a row before they lost to Florida in the SEC tournament semifinal. I don't think they're a great team, but they have, you know, quietly kind of pulled some things together, particularly defensively. And actually, the team I'd be more curious about is Nebraska. Houston is obviously so good defensively and so athletically gifted. But Nebraska is just one of those teams that, you know, they can just make 15 threes in a night, even against a good defense, even against a good team. And then suddenly, you know, you're kind of fighting uphill. Suddenly you're having to go bucket for bucket, and maybe the game's not being played on your terms quite the way you'd like it to be, and all those kinds of things. I think all four will get through. The one I maybe have my eye on most would be Houston, but that's matchup dependent, and that's, you know, that's frankly also just kind of dependent on essentially Nebraska just sort of, you know, getting out of its head a little bit unexpectedly, not necessarily something you could predict.
Who will be the biggest seed eliminated? Will it be a 2 or a 3 before the Sweet 16, if you tell me all the ones are going?
Let's see.
Your two.
I can see a world where Iowa State has some trouble. You know, South Dakota State's not necessarily vintage this year, but
they won their league. I mean,
that is a program that's done some winning. I also think Washington State and Drake each would present their own sort of challenge in that second round matchup. You know, Arizona, I mean, I wouldn't be in love with playing Nevada and Salt Lake City. I wouldn't be in love with playing Dayton, period.
Right.
So those two I could see. It's a little bit harder for me to see Marquette or Tennessee just on the matchups alone, although Colorado State I think is a better team than it's been given credit for by the committee. I think it showed that last night.
So I don't like Rick Barnes either. I don't like Barnes. You can have Barnes.
Well, and I'm speaking more in the aggregate here. I'm speaking more in terms of the law of large numbers. If you made me pick, I would probably say a two goes down this weekend.
They usually do.
Over a three. But just because I can see enough, I can see enough trouble for twos that, you know, all it kind of takes is one. But even then, it's kind of like I'm sort of assuming a certain matchup in a second round setting that maybe doesn't wind up coming to pass. It's, you know, I'm not necessarily sitting here willing to stake my house on, you know, telling you which team it's going to be, if that makes any sense.
ESPN.com tells me not only has a 15 seed won a first round game in three consecutive tournaments for the first time, but all three went on to reach the Sweet 16 as well. So good insight there without knowing that fact ahead of time, my friend. Safe travels. I know you don't have far to go. You have the Boilermakers. That's going to be an interesting story one way or the other. And we'll get caught up with you after the first and second rounds next week before you make the trip to Detroit. And we'll see what has transpired. Thanks for all your help with IU Hoops and the tournament this week, buddy. Great job.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, as always.
That's Zach Osterman from the IndyStar.com. Our insider for hoopage of all kinds. And this time of year, sadly, not as much Indiana on the court as opposed to off of it. And you can hear our full interview at WGCLradio.com. Have a great Wednesday night. We will be with back Pacer basketball starting at 7 o'clock in Detroit tonight against the Pistons. And then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, noon, until the games are over, the NCAA tournament. Kent Sterling will get you ready to go in the mornings for Thursday and Friday as well, so make sure you tune in, and I'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great Wednesday night. The Crazy Horse Tavern Happy Hour is over.